Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hagan. I'm working
at an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, hello, everybody. It's another snowy or about to be snowy day as we come to you from Denver in the Antarctic.
I saw it's a third. The CDOT was tweeting it's a 33rd storm of the season. I'm like, seriously? Seriously?
Yes. April snows bring May blizzards.
Blizzards. And we're doing something wrong. We were talking with the Chronicle bookkeeper today who lives in the Bahamas now. And it's like, what's wrong with this? But she's like, oh, I'm a little sunburned. We were on the water all day yesterday. Oh, well. Hey, a lot going on today on the show. We're going to have some good news, actually.
Who we brought by, Julie?
Oh, I'm sorry. AmericasCitizenPress.com. Not just Colorado, but America's conservative voice. And Denver Synogenics and Dr. Julie McCallan. Hey, I want to thank her. She did a great job.
She did a lot of positive responses.
Yeah. When we had her on the show on Friday. Coming up at 3:15, we're going to have Bruce Baker. He's a Westminster resident, former city council member. Once again, another win for the citizens. And in spite of City Hall, they just won a court battle over...
You are naive, Julie.
All right, I know. But being hopeful...
Justice delayed is justice denied. I'll explain to you why that is.
Do not be hopeful. Juggle, not be hopeful. Hey, we've talked a lot about sort of controversial, and that's putting it nicely, Denver Public School Board member Tay Anderson has a slew of women from Black Lives Matter accusing him of some sort of inappropriate, everything from sexual conduct to sexual assault. So investigations going on there. Well, now Campaign Integrity Watchdog has filed a financial disclosure complaint against him because all he does is raise money on his Target baby registry and GoFundMe pages, which, of course, he fails to report. We'll talk to Matt Arnold on that. And we had a great conversation with John Eastman.
Lunch with him on Sunday.
A Trump insider.
And
we got that.
His beautiful wife.
Right. And thank you to Ramey Johnson, by the way, from Lakewood for hosting
that.
And Walt. But I want to start off with the Chauvin trial. Closing arguments going on today. Actually, they're taking most of the day. You know, I've covered like a million of the, maybe a million.
No.
I guess maybe thousands. Probably what will happen is the prosecution is giving its rebuttal right now. Then the judge goes through the jury instructions, which essentially outlines the case. My guess is the jurors will deliberate very briefly. They're sequestering them in a hotel. And so they're not going to be going
home. You just don't know, juries. I can tell you one thing I've learned is you just don't know.
Yeah, this is my assessment. And I got to admit, I did not watch the whole trial at all. I watched some of the closing arguments. And Chuck, we'll get your thing. To me, this is obviously Derek Chauvin, the officer accused of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, or manslaughter in the George Floyd death. To me, this seems like one of those cases where it's just going to depend on, I think, who the jury is going to hold more responsible. And now this is taking politics out because I think...
Which you can't.
But I think it comes down to... So both men, it seems to me, played a role. They did things and they failed to do things that probably could have prevented or contributed to the death. George Floyd was high on what the evidence showed was a fatal amount of fentanyl and other drugs. He was resisting arrest in that state, which caused other problems. On the other hand, Derek Chauvin, although he was doing, the defense argues what he was trained to do, I think one could also say that if he had, he was kneeling on the guy. Now, he did not die of asphyxiation, so that's important to remember, though.
That's what some of the witnesses said he did.
Well, all right. That's controversial, I guess.
Okay,
let me put it that way.
That's a different thing.
The medical examiner, I think the overall consensus, and the prosecution is kind of conceding this if you listen to their closing arguments, the cause of death was not immediately he suffocated because the officer was kneeling on his neck. There were other things. But I think arguably, or if you're a juror, you could look at it and say, well, the officer could have looked sooner. The officer could have done something sooner.
He never looked down.
Well, at any point. Well,
sooner.
He did after he was dead.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's going to depend on how the jurors hold different people responsible there. And, you know, and I think then you throw in the politics. To me, I would not be surprised at all by a second-degree murder conviction on the harshest charge. I just, you know, if I wish that the jurors could take all of the everything going on not into consideration, but I can't imagine that they
will. Well, you never know with juries. The thing about juries is it's a negotiation. You have 12 people, and who are the strongest voices? When you do trials, you try to figure out who are the people for you, who are the people against you, which is why you have jury consultants throughout the trial if you can afford it.
Right.
And try to arm your people with the best arguments to make against those people who are against you. And you just never know the inner dynamics of a jury and how persuasive, if they are, not everyone agrees immediately on the charges and stuff. And it'd probably be difficult to agree as to which of the charges to come.
You know,
but Maxine Waters, that great liberal
calling for violence and confrontation and take
which
to the streets.
Which is certainly okay.
Because having listened to none of the testimony, by the way, she's decided the guy is guilty. It's like, why, under the Democrats, why do we even, that's just like Antifa and the mob rule. That's what the Twitter folks decide. Look at all the money we could save if we didn't just have to worry about the law and justice and things like that. If we could just have the cancel culture mob control everything.
But Nancy Pelosi, although she demanded an impeachment of Trump for inciting a riot, it was no need to apologize for Maxine Waters because that's not how Democrats rule.
Right. No, I mean, it's even CNN was kind of critical of her, but that was just, but they said, that's nothing compared to what Trump said, which of course it is nothing compared to what Trump said because
he
Trump
said
didn't say anything, nothing like it. You know, I will say this though, take away the politics, because I've covered again, trials like this. I could see this outside of that in a normal time and in a normal thing being the kind of case where there is a hung jury or even an acquittal because you would have, there was a great deal of testimony in the closing arguments presenting that this is what Chauvin was trained to do, that, you know, it was an excited delirium case maybe, and that he did not intentionally cause the death. And I have seen trials where police officers, you look at it, you're like, yeah, man, I don't know. But then the jury in the end comes down and says the officer didn't intend to do it. The officer was doing what he was trained to do, and he gets acquitted. So we've seen that happen a lot.
Well, I think the benefit of the doubt for police officers in major cities
is gone. We have a couple of sound bites, though, so let's play that just to give you a taste. This is a sound bite from the prosecutor in the first part of the closing arguments that were presented earlier today. So, Thomas, if we could play this prosecutor sound bite, please.
The defendant did was not policing. What the defendant did was an assault. I'm going to discuss the law with you in a bit here and explain. The court's already provided you some instructions on second degree murder, and you know that in the laws of this state, if you commit a certain level of assault, a felony level assault, and a person dies as a result of your assault, you're guilty of murder. It's as simple as that. And what the defendant did here was a straight up felony assault. This was not policing. It was unnecessary. It was gratuitous. It was disproportionate. And he did it on purpose. No question. This was not an accident. He did not trip and fall and find himself upon George Floyd's knee and neck. He did what he did on purpose. And it killed George Floyd.
Now, that's the second degree murder charge. I would argue, absent the politics of it, I think you might have a hard time convincing jurors that an officer dealing with a suspect resisting arrest is assaulting the suspect. Yes. The third degree murder charge, which is another thing that they could convict him of, that's where he caused the death by an intentional act that was dangerous and basically in having reckless disregard for life. I could see that being a charge, and also the manslaughter, which is, you know, he caused the death by culpable negligence. I would say in normal times, the manslaughter charge might be the one.
Well, it's not manslaughter, it's third degree felony.
Well, no,
it's a third degree. It's not a. It's not a.
It's not manslaughter. It's a second. It's manslaughter in the second degree. Yeah. So it's a little different than the Colorado law. But there's a difference there. I would say I don't know. I would say that it'd be hard to, in normal times, convince a juror that a police officer subduing someone who was resisting arrest was assaulting the person. You know, like I said, I think absent George Floyd resisting arrest, he'd probably be alive today. Absent him having a fatal dose of drugs in his system, he'd probably be alive today. And yet also, arguably, if the police officer had, you know, done anything other than just do what he did, taken any mitigating actions, he would be alive.
You'd love to be able to put, if you were on the defense, Chauvin, on the stand to show his regret, show his remorse.
What was going through his head.
It was going through his head. Obviously, they didn't think he'd show enough. And the opposite, his arrogance, his lack of empathy of people would come through, as well as whatever else is in his past. But let's see the
defense soundbite, please, Thomas.
Beings capable of making mistakes in highly stressful situations. In this case, the totality of the circumstances that were known to a reasonable police officer in the precise moment the force was used demonstrates that this was an authorized use of force, as unattractive as it may be. And this is reasonable doubt. Steiger talked about being on the panel, right? They have five officers on a panel to assess whether uses of force are reasonable. Sometimes it's 4-1. Sometimes it's 3-2. Sometimes it's 5-0. Because the reasonableness of the use of force is not an easy, easy thing to consider.
So there again, but he's arguing, I think, in normal times. I think that in these times, the jurors are well aware of what's going on. The jurors, as you said, the police officer is sort of having an inherent sort of benefit of the doubt kind of in their favor.
Yeah,
I think that is gone now. I think one thing that's interesting, though, you know, prosecution, what they had, like some 38 witnesses over 11 days. I think in the end, it's going to just come down to the medical examiner's testimony and what they make of that and the videotape. I mean, there are 8 million videotapes, and both sides in their closing arguments are isolating certain things, saying, well, when they show you that, but then you got to look at this. What I think is the jurors have all of that, well, right?
Having trials, and sometimes the jurors will talk to you afterward about what they came and why they came to their decision. And I had a case up in Boulder County, and I wanted to know whether my cross had been effective. Did I have a good closing argument? And it's a case I won. It's a lot more fun to ask the jurors after you've won than you've lost. He said, no, it was that joke you told Bud Vaudier about the farmer. I thought that was great.
Exactly.
And after that, I was all on your side. And you kind of go, jurors often make up their mind early on. And it's often based, I mean, they'll tell you something. But it really is an amazing. I can tell you, I would not have dressed the defendant in that outfit he was in. I would not have him give that demeanor. I mean, he ought to spend a few days with a coach of how to come a sympathetic and not arrogant.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about this, because I know, you know, defense attorneys, one of the biggest things is, do you put the person on the stand?
Right.
And I think in a case like this, typically I know in cases like this, they practice, right? They bring in people and they do the questioning, they do the cross-examination, they see how they do, and they play hardball in that. They want to see the defendant at the worst, that if you're the defense attorney there. And the fact that they did not put him on the stand, sometimes that's a sign that they think that, you know, they won, so they don't have to worry about it. But normally, I think that you're absolutely right. I think they must have tried, and he must not have come across very, very well. Well, and you can see that. Sometimes it's not always fair to judge people. I mean, I think what hurt him a lot was when he's kneeling on the neck, or wherever he's kneeling, he's got his hands in his pockets, and he's just kind of, he's not reacting at all.
He's aggressively staring at the people.
No, I can understand. If you're a cop, maybe,
there's an arrogance, there's a hatefulness in that face that you can't
Well, it sure looked, he looked that way. Now, whether he was feeling that inside.
Well, you can never tell what somebody's
right.
feeling. Right,
but I think that did not.
I don't think he is feeling a lot of empathy at the time.
Right.
And so I think
well, I go back to, remember the kid, the Covington school kid, who confronted, you know, that Nicholas Sandman cage, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Where mm-hmm. one of the things I think that was the kid was standing there and people were interpreting his look as smirking mm-hmm. and arrogance. Mm-hmm. And he was saying far from it. He was trying really hard right. to keep a neutral face. Right. So you get a caution against that. On the other hand, though,
if you're a juror, you see what you see.
Right.
And you depend upon Nicholas Sandman to say, no, I just, you know, right. I was intimidated and everything else, which is reasonable, and
right.
here you don't get any of that because he doesn't take the stand. But they must have felt it was something. That
it was something, and I'm going to go ahead and eliminate. We've got Barney. We'll get to Barney, and then Thomas can go ahead and call Bruce Baker. I'm going to make a prediction. Having though said that, I'm always wrong on these predictions. So if you're don't bet on this. But with the jury being sequestered, I think they're going to want to hurry up and get it done. So I'm going to guess we have a verdict either Thursday afternoon or Friday morning. I think that
when do they wrap up? When do they go into?
I imagine they wrap up this afternoon. Now maybe they'll come back. I don't know.
Yeah, Tuesday. Well, that's not a quick verdict.
Oh no. Well, I think sometimes in a case like this, you've got a lot of stuff to go through.
Well, you don't have to go through. Yeah, but somebody says, "Hey, you know,
I wouldn't be surprised in this case to have the jurors ask to see some of the videotapes and things like that.
Deliberating. I would say
you're not even optimistic they're going to deliberate.
Well, they sometimes don't. I mean, the conventional wisdom, and it's not true in some cases, but a quick verdict is bad for the defendant.
Yes.
And a longer one makes it
depending
more likely.
Depending on how long.
How long makes it more likely you're going to get at least a hung jury.
Well, or maybe a second-degree murder or something. Charlene is saying, you're right, Julie. The clips we saw show the cop to be callous. I think you're right. Hey, let's go to Barney with us. Hey, Barney, thank you for calling in.
Chuck and Julie, not that you give a damn what I think, but I figured I'd throw it
we
out.
We do that. That's why we do this. We care what you think. That's why it's a call-in show.
Okay, for starters, the defense attorney isn't a jerk. He doesn't sound like a jerk. He doesn't act like a pipsqueak, so they're already winning that one. And I think the
prosecutor
does
looked
kind of,
like the prosecutor. The prosecutor looked like the actor.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I would say, and I don't like this cop. I think he's a jerk. Mm-hmm. I don't think that he intended to kill the guy. I really don't. I don't like the way cops. I think the biggest thing that might burn him is when the paramedic came up that was in plain clothes and said, you know, whatever. But he can say, I didn't hear it. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know, but do you know what I mean? I mean, that would have been denying the medical whatever, and you don't know who this woman is. You know, maybe she's an ass clown from the crowd. So
right.
I don't. And by the way, Julie, I think this goes into next week. I think this is going to be a.
I know this though. I know Julie when they're because here's the thing, Barney. They're staying at a hotel, right? Depends on how nice a hotel is. And the food, right? In my experience,
usually there's a rush to judgment once Friday comes along.
I've seen that happen. I can't tell you how many times I've covered verdicts that come down Friday afternoon because I think
the idea of spending the weekend with the people you've been arguing with for all week long.
Oh, yeah.
If it goes to next week, it's good news for Chauvin.
I don't know.
I just have a feeling it's going to be a hard one to sort out. But we didn't know all this stuff that the guy was in the car at first and he swallowed the drug. You know, all Floyd would have had to done was say, hey man, I swallowed the drugs. Boom, they take him to the hospital. It'd have been over.
Right.
There wouldn't have been,
right.
You know, there's a lot of this could have been, and I don't know a lot of medical examiners, but I will have to say, I will give them the benefit of the doubt because most of those guys that have done that for years, they really do know their crap, and they know probably more about living and dying than most doctors do. So I definitely give them the benefit of the doubt. If he says he died of the fentanyl no matter what, then, so I don't know. It is what it is. But I think this lawyer, he just doesn't come across as a scumbag, and I think that's good for the cop.
The defense attorney, from what I saw in the closing arguments, both sides did a capable job, really.
Your prosecutor, he kind of in that statement that you showed, I mean, yeah, it was legal because it's closing arguments. He can say whatever the hell he wants, But he said that, no, it was intentional. I mean, he could have worded that a little different way, but I'm not impressed with the prosecutor.
Well, he's using the word intentional because he's trying to get him to convict him of second-degree murder. There's a different thing for the third-degree murder and for the manslaughter. It doesn't have to be intentional. Okay, for second degree murder, there has to be intent. So he's going for intent. So he had to say that. I think that's a stretch. Well, again, I mean, let's say you're a juror, right? And you're you don't see it, but you know your city's burning. There are riots all over the place. I just think that's going to play an unfair role. Mm-hmm. Hey, but we'll see.
Now, we've got with us a person who we admire and like here in Westminster. Former Councilman Bruce Baker is on line 3. Bruce, are you there?
You bet I'm here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good to hear from you. So you had a court victory.
You betcha.
Tell us about it.
Well, why don't you give us a little bit of background, Bruce?
That's even better.
Yeah, let people know what we're talking about, Jack.
It's a good point, Bruce.
Okay, background. The council raised the water rates to outrageous levels back in 2018. We elected two decent council people in 2019, but we still didn't have a majority. So when we had the dryness of 2020, and when in June of 2020, the three good guys on council implored, begged, asked any one of the four other people to switch their minds and lower the water rates, and they all said no. A group of folks in the original part of Westminster said, well, we've had it, that's enough. And we started a recall drive to recall all four of those guys.
Right. And we got the signatures.
So we gathered, we basically spent the months of September and October, we gathered roughly 6,700 signatures for each one of the four to be recalled. And the clerk, when she made her review, found reasons to throw out enough signatures to say there weren't enough signatures on any of the petitions.
That was a clerk, right?
And it was a clerk, and it was just like a technicality, right? It wasn't like she found that they weren't valid or the person hadn't signed them. It was some kind of, but she, and essentially, as I understand it, a technicality she just frankly made up.
No, she didn't just make it up, but there's a cover sheet that they gave to, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bruce, had a cover sheet telling people, you know, get them all four signed and other things, to trying to make sure that everybody who was doing the petition drive was doing it properly. But that cover sheet had not been approved by the clerk, so she said that tainted
everything.
Those things. Is that essentially
absolutely correct, Chuck? Basically, the people who really organized the drive had a 19-page section which they got approved by the city clerk. But because of COVID and we couldn't have mass meetings and we couldn't have training sessions, what the person did was put on a cover sheet, which ended up being labeled page 1, because that's what our computers do for us. And it was actually telling the circulators all the rules they needed to follow. And we sent this out by email, and a lot of people just took that email and printed up those full 20 pages. And one of the things we asked was to keep all the pages fastened together. And she even suggested you staple them. And so what happened is a lot of people did staple them. And the night before we turned in the petitions, the gal running the recall said, page 1 was instructions, it's not supposed to be on there. So we took those page 1s off on lots of sections that were done. And the clerk, when she did her review, found tiny paper scraps trapped under a staple. Because what we turned in followed exactly to the form, except for 14 sections, followed exactly to the form of the approved petition. That's why we took the cover page off. And the clerk found tiny scraps under some of the things. She even got, it turns out, I mean, the police forensic photographer to come over and take pictures of these like this was some huge
crime. Oh, my gosh. Let me set the stage for folks so people know, because if they're not familiar, because we've been covering this for a while. But so Westminster, you know, we're a Denver suburb, a nice suburb, neighborhoods, okay? Single family homes, nice yards, green belts, things like
also
that.
Also a lot of apartments.
And apartments these days. But I mean, it's your basic sort of nice suburb. And what the Westminster City Council has decided is they want to social engineer us all into high density housing. And so we can't have any water. And so our water rates went, for instance, at our property, we just have a regular size yard, right? It went from literally like maybe $63, maybe $100 in the height of the summer when we were watering the lawn to over $300, $400 a month. We heard from the petition gatherers, we had some elderly people who had lived in their homes, gorgeous gardens, who were getting water bills of over $1,000 a month, when some of the highest in the country. The city council's trying to shove this down our throat, and this is, I'm just getting riled up here, but the city clerk, rather than saying, hey, look, I work for you, the citizens. No, she went out of her way, the clerk did, to basically screw the citizens and shove this petition drive down the garbage. But you guys did not stop, did you, Bruce? You took it to court and you won.
Absolutely. And that is really the creepy part, because we had to set precedent here. I mean, our case has set precedent in Colorado, because the judge ruled, and the judge, I got to say, did a great job in this case, because I was there the whole time, as was in there, and this guy listened. There was even some time where the plaintiff and the defendant got really confused in where they were, and the judge told them, you're right here, boys. So he was actively listening, and we had our last hearing on April the 9th. A week later, at April the 16th, at 10:43 in the evening, the judge put up his ruling. This judge knows that elections are important and they have to be timely handled. And you know, I mean, the city in our way.
I might dispute that. you filed your case in the beginning of January. This is mid-April. What is going to happen now, what I predict, is they will appeal it. They'll appeal it to the Court of Appeals, and you'll run out the clock.
Well, they're going to try to make you run out of money. So let's go
no,
back.
No, they're not trying to run out of money, Julie.
Well, the clock it's, and money.
No.
Okay.
No. It's unless you get an emergency ruling from the Colorado Court of Appeals, and then they'll appeal that to the Supreme Court. Because within 90 days, as Bruce was telling me, you know, then it merges into the new election, which is in November. So
correct.
they will appeal this, because I've done these ones, and I did it in several states cities, and they would run it up and to the appeals, and that's what happened in Lakewood. When that clerk rejected all the signatures. The Court of Appeals waited almost a year and did everything else. And the judge, and he wrote, I think, a really excellent 24-page opinion that's up on the Westminster site, if you want to read it yourself. And I thought he really did a tremendous job. But justice delayed is justice denied. He should have called the hearing immediately and ruled immediately. I mean, here... He ruled once he got a hearing, which was on April 9th, 7th and 9th, I guess. I mean, he had it within a week. So it's now it's going to be appealed to the Court of Appeals.
Todd, don't be a downer.
I'm not being a downer. I'm telling you what happens in the law.
Well, but I want, again, just to set so folks understand what's happening here. So this is the citizens of Westminster before the vote, after the vote, surrounding this outrageous water bill situation. And this is not a political, this is nonpartisan. This is just people.
Well, it's not totally nonpartisan. Well, all the Democrats and the emerged candidates,
the city council members,
the far left, and along with Herb the Hat Hutchinson, is a Republican. Although it's interesting, the Colorado Republican Party had refused to endorse him when he ran for mayor. But as a practical matter, unless you can get an emergency ruling from the Court of Appeals and they don't try to take it to the Supreme Court, It'll be too late.
Here's why that is so outrageous, and then Bruce, I want you to comment on that. So again, these are our elected city officials, okay? The citizens of Westminster made it clear during these hearings, made it clear after the hearings, have made it clear for, since this whole thing came up, they did not want these outrageous, unnecessary water rates, because that's something else. There's no reason for these water rates to go up. They're solely trying to social engineer us to get rid of single family homes and pack us into high density housing and make it too expensive. Our neighbors just completely tore out all the grass and it's all rock now, right? And they're like, can't afford it. Can't afford the water. And they had a gorgeous yard.
They did.
And these are our city council elected representatives who are saying, screw you, citizens. We don't care what you think. We have a city staff, the employees who say, screw you, citizens. We work for you. We don't care what you guys think. And Bruce, you guys have done a great, courageous job not giving up no matter what they throw at you.
One thing I did not agree with the judge's ruling. He noted that the city clerk does not report to the city council, but the city manager, and therefore, you know, she's not under any pressure to do what the majority of the mayor and everyone else. Anybody who's ever been in a city knows the clerk either toes the line or it's gone. And the idea that just because she reports to the city manager, reports to the mayor and city council makes no difference.
Do we know who the clerk is?
Yes.
Yes. Her name is, Michelle Parker. And as Chuck said, she is an at-will employee of the city manager. And basically, there was an article in the Westminster Window by Bill of the Christopher observing that, the city manager is keeping his job by one vote on city council, which is why if there's a recall election, he could lose his job.
And then you get another lawsuit because he'll have written himself an incredible
golden parachute,
which you have to say violates. You got to find the various provisions, and then you got to negotiate it as he's leaving town. He doesn't want to be caught in this litigation.
Bruce, what's next for you guys? So I know, and Chuck, I know, is being realistic, unfortunately.
But I've done it. I mean, I've been there.
But that's how Bruce is.
That's stupid.
No, it's not. But for the brief moment of hope, Bruce, what do you guys, what's going on now then? Where does it go from here?
Well, I have to agree with Chuck's observations. You know, he's lived in the real world. And some of us on the recall are sort of still living in Pollyanna world. But our best hope is that on the 28th, we know without a doubt we have enough valid signatures to recall the mayor. Okay? And once the date of the clerk's certificate of really sufficiency is dated, that starts a clock. And they have 60 days, no more than 60 days, to hold a recall election. And the only way that would be defeated is if the mayor resigned. And that would start a whole number series. But, Chuck probably knows more about the appeals process than I do. And, I was sort of thrilled when we got the opinion of the judge. Not only that,
great opinion. He handled very well it quickly. Written, 24 pages and very well written.
What did the judge say?
He just said, the question is not whether this is a minor violation of Westminster statutes and state recall. Has there been substantial compliance? And he said, absolutely, the people doing it intended to comply with every manner they did. Having the cover page affected, incredibly small percentage of the signatures. And this is just a matter of minor noncompliance. And of course, the city attorney, I promise you, is working with the city clerk, figuring additional ways to
throw out.
And then go from there. That's the game they play. And that's what our courts never realize. I mean, I took one where it took me a year and a half before I finally got the Supreme Court to deny the appeal from the Court of Appeals, who found out for me. And then there was only about 6 months until the next one. But let me finish.
I'm sorry.
And we lost that recall, but it had such an enormous effect that the entire city council and whoever their friends were got thrown out in the election a month later. Or 2 months.
Well,
later.
And I think Bruce. Yeah.
And that's so. You know, it has an enormous ability to focus people on the water rates, and so this new election in November should be based on the water rates again, and not having, I've heard, although I disagree in all my times in local politics, you know, slates don't win. On a question of water rates, they would win.
Yeah.
And it's sad that they don't realize that that's a winning record. Say, we will, this slate will repeal those ones. You've got an enormous amount, and they'll try to pick off one or two or everything else, but people do what they want to do.
That is true, is I agree that, okay, the real answer is going to come at the November general election. And we've already got candidates ready. Well, I am announced as really one of the people running for council in the fall. You know, we would hope that we could change it before that election.
Yeah.
But because we don't want to see these high water rates. What I mean, you and Julie observed.
Yes.
Part of the value of our homes is what our neighborhood looks like.
Right.
A lot of
it's also a wise buyer calculates all their costs on what their mortgage, what their water rates, what the other ones, and therefore you say, okay, I can afford, let's say, a $5,000 mortgage. Well, the water rates affect that, what you can afford altogether. And so it depreciates not only how the city looks as our neighbor is zero scape in their yard, but the cost, your home value, based on all the costs that somebody has to undertake. It's sort of amazing. I mean, I really hope there's an opportunity for at least the mayor, Herb, who is well deserves to be recalled. I hope he resigns or is called, because he's been mayor. He's been a leech on the city for decades. And for him for him to be unceremoniously kicked out would be a wonderful
send a message. Evelyn, first, here's what I want you to comment briefly too, because we only have about five more minutes. Because we've talked about these kind of issues with you before. If people think that this is just a Westminster issue, they have their heads in the sand, right? This is coming to a city near everybody, isn't it?
Oh yes,
absolutely, Julie. You are absolutely right. You know, whether you want to call it George Bush's New World Order, or whether you want to call it Agenda 21, or whatever you want to call it, it's taught in every architecture school in the country to basically rip away suburbs from us. And suburbs, in my view, is where the American dream came to life.
And they hate the
most
valuable
financial asset most Americans have.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Bruce, listen, we got to let you go. Thank you for the fight. Keep us posted.
One other thing, Bruce.
Oh.
One other thing. I promise to keep on giving you some money. So if you want to stop by tonight, I promise you to give a check for Scott Gessler, who's the attorney on the thing, and one for your campaign, if you want to drop by.
Well, I'll drop by then.
All right. Bruce Baker, thank you once again for all you're doing and for your time this afternoon. Appreciate it. Now we've got with us Matt Arnold with Campaign Integrity Watchdog. Matt, I see that you're on Zoom. If you want to go ahead and turn your camera on and unmute yourself, then we can bring you on. Hey there.
Yeah, absolutely. Just standing by. So
standing by. I know when you're busy. So you are you are Campaign Integrity Watchdog. You do more legal work for a non-lawyer than any lawyer in Colorado.
But he's going to law school.
Just to clarify, technically, I am not Campaign Integrity Watchdog. Campaign Integrity Watchdog is a business that has a separate legal entity. So I know some folks are trying to declare that CIW is my alter ego. It is not. It's a separate legal entity. But yes, I represent Campaign Integrity Watchdog in litigation. Going after
somebody's tapping on your shoulder there, we can see. Somebody's tapping on your shoulder.
I know.
Yes. It's my kiddo. Just got out of school. So that's
you have the most adorable kids. So we want to talk about Tate Anderson. People may be familiar with him. Very controversial Denver public school board member who is basically just using it as a stepping stone to get publicity and, as it turns out, money. Has been raising all kinds of money. He's got GoFundMe pages. He has his his girlfriend got pregnant, so he puts links on his Twitter account to their baby registry, and people fool it. I can't believe people are actually buying him stuff. But you have discovered theoretically he has to be claiming all of this, or at least disclosing it. But lo and behold, he's just taking the cash and running.
Well, apparently, and obviously, there's no accounting of all of this money that he's been raking in. He's raking in, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. So, you know, so I guess pretty soon you're talking real money. But all of this is, and this is why we have these disclosure requirements in place, because T. Anderson is a public official. He's an elected official. And there are limits, there are disclosure requirements for elected officials. The whole point of all of this is to prevent quid pro quo corruption and not being able to use your political office for personal gain. And it sure looks like T. Anderson has been profiting enormously personally from his public service, quote unquote, service, his public office in any case.
Yeah.
And has been raking in donations from credible people. Oh, yeah, Tay, let's support him. Which is way outside the bounds of what should be happening in political office.
Well,
and there's no accounting for it. There's been no reporting of it. So, I mean, who knows where the money's going?
Well, and it's going to him because he's not running a campaign, right? I mean, the money was for when he attended.
Well, it didn't go to his campaign account. Again, there's a whole line of requirements for reporting that money, and there are limit contribution limits and disclosure requirements, periodic reports that have to be filed. This is money that has been donated to him outside of that. So outside of the whole campaign
right.
Account structure, and it sure looks like just a T. Anderson slush fund.
Multiple slush funds. Can you talk about, because he's had his people, and so he'll say, well, it wasn't me. Well, it's like, well, okay, it was your campaign person, and you know, so he,
exactly.
he's a recipient of the money.
So the one case was, so he attends a homeless protest, and it gets a little chaotic. He falls down.
There's a crap ball.
Claims that he has to go to the hospital and get treated.
And I have a picture of him in the hospital, and it looks like a hospital bed.
Right.
With a little mask on, and it's just
apparently we've never seen any medical bills, but he starts a GoFundMe page to get people to give him money to pay his medical bills. He starts another right. one of people to give him money to take people to Washington, D.C. to see.
Including himself.
I mean, like you said, right. And then he's got the link to the Target baby registry, for God's sakes. So walk us through some of the things he's done and why that is problematic.
And that last is especially egregious. I mean, first off, for the medical slush fund, I'm sorry, for the medical contribution expense coverage fund, alleged, like you said, there is no accounting of the medical bills. And part of this appeal was, well, I don't have insurance. Poor me. Well, funny about that. I mean, all the Democrats have been touting, well, the public option and all these other options. And, oh, by the way, as a Denver school board member, you probably have access to, the
Denver their insurance.
Public schools insurance. So that all sounds kind of suspicious. But the other part, the whole, the fact-finding trip to Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that's even expressly and explicitly pointed out in the regulation as something that must be reported. So it's not like there are some broad categories. This is something that is absolutely concrete, black and white, specific. That kind of thing has got to be reported.
Right.
And he hasn't filed report one on any of this.
And then, and again, this is T. Anderson, who is under investigation for various sexual issues, sex harassment, sex assault. The Black Lives Matter.
You maybe have a new GoFundMe page for sex addiction pretty soon.
Right. I mean, it's, well, and is this the kind of stuff that didn't John Hickenlooper, this is sort of the kind of stuff that he got in trouble with too, when he was flying around on planes with his friends and things like that and not disclosing.
Yeah. And again, the whole rationale behind this is just for this purpose, the quid pro quo corruption. People that are able to gain access to elected officials and influence policy. And that was the thing, Hickenlooper, of course, is dealing with a slightly higher class of high rollers and policy influencers. But I mean, some of the entities, you know, not just private individuals, but entities that are contributing to the Tay Anderson fact-finding slush fund have an interest in influencing public policy.
Yeah.
So it sure looks like quid pro quo corruption, which is the entire point of all these disclosure reports.
Well, and Tay Anderson seems to have this sense that the rules somehow, this is my, don't apply to him, that these are just stupid, racist requirements that he has to give up who's giving to a slush fund and report it, for God's sakes, man. Systemic racism in our campaign integrity laws.
Hey, you know, some animals are more equal than others, right?
Yeah.
That's right. So have you been able to report it yet to the district attorney for anything that they may do?
Yes, I've yet to get a response. I had to wait just, you know, with all my other things going on.
Job, you like.
Didn't get that filed until today, so I don't have a response back on that yet. But yes, I did file. With this particular law, it kind of splits. So there's the campaign finance angle, which is a campaign finance violation, and that is a civil violation. But under this particular law, it's 24.6203 in various subsections, this is also a criminal violation. So there are really sort of two paths to investigate and potentially two different paths for penalties. One, the Secretary of State, and frankly, between you, me, our millions of listeners, I have zero confidence that the Secretary of State will actually do her job and prosecute a fellow Democrat, particularly a fellow Democrat who is a high-profile Democrat with a following and someone who could, you know, make things, I guess, difficult for Ms. Griswold and her reelection campaign. And frankly, you know, it's not just that. Secretary Griswold has utterly failed to actually do her job and force any of the campaign finance violations that have been happening on her watch, with the exception of a couple of people that she'll single out.
Right.
For, you know, arbitrary and capricious enforcement that really, looking at some of these complaints, I think is of dubious legal provenance, and really it's pretty iffy. But hey, you know what the heck? If I can just arbitrarily have my deputy impose, contrary to the advice of the nonpartisan staff, contrary to the findings of an actual administrative law judge, and we'll just, you know, willy nilly impose. You know, what the hell, $20,000 on somebody just because we're beyond the realm of law. We're beyond the realm of enforcing the law. We are pretty much into the realm of political thugs and just arbitrary imposition of penalties just because.
Would these people be
Republicans? That's a very dangerous territory.
Right. Would these people be Republicans that she's targeting? Or?
Yes.
Am I correct with the Secretary of State? Like, everybody in the office who had any idea what was going on is now gone, right? I mean, it's like they had
I would say everyone. There are still some competent people in the Secretary of State. There are folks that have been around for a while. And you know, I don't want to knock the – I mean, there is a professional staff – that have been there over the course of different administrations, different parties, but they're not being allowed to do their jobs.
Yeah,
all of the control, the ultimate decisions are being made by partisan political hacks.
Right,
and there's been a rotation of these partisan political hacks. There have been two or three deputy secretaries that are being given under the new rules and under the new legislation, which is nothing more than a rubber stamp for the rules that they have put into place. And they're just, you know, again, just completely pulling it out of their fourth party contact to decide who to prosecute, how to prosecute, how much to penalize violations, if whether or not to penalize violations. And again, it's been pretty consistent that all of the legitimate complaints and violations that have been alleged by a number of people, obviously, you know, full disclosure, campaign integrity watchdog among them, have been just kicked to the curb or negotiated. They've had settlements. Funny that all of the folks Democrats or Democrat light have gotten away and have all these things settled. And meanwhile, other cases against, I think the one or two that have actually gone anywhere The Stop the Wolf Coalition is one is, it's run by someone who's a Republican. It's a conservative group, and they threw the book at them. And they went way beyond what the law really requires on a very, very iffy legal basis, and threw the book at them, $20,000.
So we'll hold our breath on Tay Anderson, but surely Democrat Beth McCann, the district attorney of Denver,
she is free.
Surely she.
Possible partisan influence.
Surely she will be getting back to you.
Yeah, again, I wouldn't hold my breath. And again, there are good people at the worker level in Denver District Attorney's office. Mm-hmm. There are folks that are working under Beth McCann that are, I think have a real commitment to upholding the law and prosecuting irrespective of partisan affiliation. And then you have the folks at the top that are very clearly motivated by political considerations, who will throw out legitimate cases against their political allies.
Well, they aren't prosecuting or investigating him for the sex assault, so I can't imagine,
the assault on the police officer or right? I mean, we're seeing this on a microcosm here in Denver. We're seeing this on the national stage that the rule of law is just being tossed out. Right. And again, not only as someone who's kind of dabbled in law, someone who is currently in law school, but more importantly, as a student of history, someone's been around the world and has seen where this goes. This is incredibly dangerous territory.
Yes.
And we are, I think, in a very dangerous moment, both here in Denver and in Colorado specifically, and in a country at large. If the law is just whatever whoever happens to be in charge says it is, we have no law. It's sheer naked force.
Well, I've thought this up before, but I went to school at the University of Salamanca in Spain under Franco, fascist.
Yeah.
I feel that was a more free country than this country is today.
Frankly, we are people are banding about a whole bunch of terms. Well, is this really socialism or communism? This is fascism. Yes. This is textbook.
Yes.
Where, I mean, the quote, the means of production technically de jure stay in the hands of the corporations. Right. But the corporations are in bed with or being directed by political considerations.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. That's a textbook fascism.
Yeah,
they are. Hey, well, you'll like this. This is from Charlene. She says they need more donations to Campaign Integrity Watchdog for this good watchdog work. Let me ask you then, Matt, two questions. One, we'll let you plug how people can help out because, you do great work there. What happens next with this these complaints that you filed against Tay Anderson for not disclosing tens of thousands of dollars in his slush fund, basically?
Right. Well, so the Secretary of State path, I'm more familiar with how that goes. And again, the Constitution rules have been just tossed out the window. And this is nonpartisan. Wayne Williams and Suzanne Steyer are responsible for undermining our state constitution by inviting a lawsuit, which they intentionally lost, I'm convinced of this, and through the case did not bother to do their job and appeal the case. So we have a federal district court judge who said, oh, no, we can't have the hoi polloi, the common people, prosecuting the law. We need to only reserve this to government officials who are, of course, themselves self-interested and corrupt. But we can't have these common people enforcing law. That would be horrible, right? So then they rewrote the rules to put draw this back into the Secretary of State's office. And wonder of wonders, the Secretary of State has never prosecuted anyone allied with whoever the current secretary happens to be. What a shock. And meanwhile, has spent tens of thousands of taxpayer dollars defending their political cronies against prosecution and appellate proceedings. So the way the process is supposed to work is under these new rules, again, in air quotes, the Secretary of State's office has 30 days to decide whether or not to, I think it's 10 days to decide whether or not the complaint is timely filed, alleges violations of law, and has sufficient factual and legal basis to proceed. Then they issue what's called a notice of initial review. And then at that point, they say, well, yeah, maybe it met all those three criteria, but then there's the next delay, where we will give the offender a chance to, quote, cure the violations. And basically, I don't know if you guys ever watched the old show, I Am Appeal. It's just fish. Oh, bygones. you know, if yes, I'm guilty of sin, but tell you what, let me just redo it and I'm off the hook. And if they're able to do that, then the Secretary of State will say, well, hey, bygones, we're all good here. We'll just dismiss it. If the violator is such an idiot or has not been able to actually, quote, cure their violations, then they can file a complaint with the administrative law judge, which is, again, constitutionally what's supposed to happen in the first place. And constitutionally, that's supposed to happen within 3 days. That would actually introduce fair due process where the accuser has to prove their case. The defender gets his day in court. Oh, no, we don't have any of that anymore. This is all going to the Secretary of State.
I really hope this gets a lot of publicity. I hope
we're going to try, yeah.
And we'll certainly notify people and everything else. But this really needs to get some publicity because it deserves it.
It's a slush fund. Thank you for your time and your hobby. Just got a minute. We got to go. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
And just real quick, if folks do want to throw a few shekels and they clear the campaign integrity watchdog pot, send anything to Campaign Integrity Watchdog at P.O. Box 372-464, Denver, Colorado, 80237. Everything is appreciated. CAW is not funded by big money campaign contributions. So, folks, if you do believe in integrity, throw a few bucks CAW's way. It would be greatly appreciated. And thank
all
you.
Right, Matt, thank you for having me on. Thank you, guys. Thank you to everybody here. Bruce Baker for calling in. ChuckandJulie.com to get everything. Thank you to Thomas for running the boards there. We will see you all on Wednesday.
Snowy Wednesday.